Let's talk to Rich Lenkoff. He's the co-host of Legal Face-Off. He's a partner, Bryce Downey and Lenkoff, the law firm, and he follows all sorts of law cases professionally and also for us here at WGN. I wanted to talk first about the $27 million George Floyd family settlement. What jumps out at you on that case?
Well, a couple things. It's a record amount. The attorneys are familiar to us on our show. One of the attorneys is a local plaintiff's attorney named Antonio Romanucci. The other attorney is Ben Crump, who is now setting another record for civil settlements. He was responsible for the first Zoom verdict ever in Florida a couple months ago, where I think he got $130, $140 million. So that's what stands out, number one. But number two, from a legal perspective, it's interesting because I think both sides are claiming that the timing of the civil suit was detrimental to the criminal side because of the timing of it. As you know, they're about halfway through picking a jury in the criminal prosecution of Derek Chauvin, the officer who has been charged in George Floyd's death. So it's interesting, John, because many look at the settlement and the timing of it as a obstacle to the prosecution. Why is that? Because prosecutors say that this taints the jury pool even further, that potential jurors must think that if the city paid $27 million to George Floyd, then there must be some liability here. On the other hand, the defense is worried with the timing of the civil settlement in that they are worried that jurors will think, well, there's already been justice in the form of this record-setting settlement, then why do I need to find against Chauvin? So it's a really interesting dynamic between the civil settlement and the criminal trial.
Will the jurors know about this, the civil settlement?
Absolutely. I mean, we know, right? We all know,
well,
so it's been out in the public. The jurors are not sequestered yet. They might be once they become jurors, but remember, right now they're only being selected. So seven have been selected. There's another seven to go. So if you're sitting in the jury pool, you obviously know about the settlement. That's why the timing has been questionable.
Well,
that's what led to the criminal attorney yesterday, requesting a continuance from the judge.
Why do you think then the city did that? Why did they give that amount of money in advance of the criminal trial?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, you know, there's a lot of speculation that they did so purposely to affect the criminal trial. They are alleging that it had nothing to do with it, that, you know, this is a state criminal prosecution versus a city settlement, and one has nothing to do with the other. But, you know, the timing was certainly curious.
Well, it does sound like they're trying to buy favor, but I'm a little surprised that the city, in the name of saving one police officer from going to jail who maybe should go to jail, would spend $27 million to save him.
Well, it's a really interesting point because one of the allegations in the criminal case that the defense is going to put forward, a very strong allegation in my opinion, is that Chauvin was following textbook procedure that has been in place by the city, by the police department for years. So the allegation in the civil complaint would be not only is Chauvin guilty civilly or responsible, more accurately, civilly, but that the police department and the city are responsible as well. So that's the answer to your question. Why would they pay so much? Because there's liability beyond Chauvin. But again, in the criminal case, it's very important. That point is very important because Chauvin is alleging that he was merely following orders and procedure.
$27 million. Does the attorney probably get a third? So the family's going to get maybe, 18 million dollars?
Yeah, absolutely. Notably, though, they put aside, I think, $500,000 to the community, the area specifically around where George Floyd was killed, you know, for neighborhood improvements and so forth. That was part of the settlement. But yes, the attorneys generally get a third, and then the balance goes to the family. And, you know, one of the questions always is, well, how do you come up with $27 million, right? And the answer is there's no exact numerical equation for that. You award things like pain and suffering and the loss of income that Mr. Floyd would have earned for his family, etc. But again, this is a record setting amount, so it really is a large amount.
I wonder if the city is trying to forestall violence if the community doesn't get the verdict it wants by, again, as you said, saying, well, it's not like we didn't do what we could. We gave them $27 million.
That cannot be ignored. I mean, I think everyone is going to be on pins and needles throughout the course of the trial, and then when the verdict is read, if it comes back as not guilty, then yes, I think you're going to see, you know, some of what we saw over the summer. It may even harken back to the O.J. Simpson verdict.
Yeah, think about that.
You know, so, or that Rodney King verdict, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's that's definitely in the minds of anyone who is making decisions.
Got to be careful how you play that hand, though, because you can't just stand up in front of TV cameras and say, hey, hey, but don't riot because we gave him $27 million. That you don't want to obviously say we paid off. We bought this settlement. We bought this verdict. So y'all don't riot out there, even though now the police officer goes free. But maybe that'll be in the back of the community's mind.
Yeah, I think given the notoriety of this case and the video, this will be even a bigger deal than Rodney King if this officer goes free, because of the perception in the mind of almost everyone that Derek Chauvin was seen on video murdering George Floyd. Now, remember, this is a criminal case. You have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he is responsible criminally. And the defense has done a pretty good job so far, I think, in previewing their defense. You know, they said that he started saying, I can't breathe, well before he was, restrained by Chauvin. They're alleging that he was taking drugs and under the influence of a considerable amount of drugs. So, again, I would caution anyone watching this trial, and everyone will watch it, to keep an open mind. I'm not saying I don't believe that Chauvin is guilty, but the defense will put forth what seems like a pretty compelling case so far.
Rich Lankoff's on a phone line. Some other cases I want to talk to Rich about. Maybe you do, too. What's happening with the Capitol arrests? What's happening with that one case where the bear spray was sprayed on a police officer who eventually died? Rich Lankoff's on a phone line. His podcast is Legal Face Off. He's the co-host of that. He's a partner at Bryce Downey & Lankoff. It's a law firm in Chicago, and Rich is off and on with us to explain some legal things. We were talking just a little bit ago about the George Floyd settlement and ensuing trial on the criminal side, but let's talk a little bit about the storming of the Capitol. So a couple more people have been arrested. The guys that, there's more than two, but famously sprayed bear spray at a police officer. What's going on here, Rich?
Yeah, John, until now we thought that Brian Sicknick, the police officer who died during the storming of the Capitol, we thought that he died because of a fire hydrant to the head. It turns out that he was, or a fire extinguisher, I should say,
yeah.
Not a hydrant. It turns out that two men, as you mentioned, have been arrested and charged with assault. Now, we don't know yet, because the investigation is not complete, whether the bear spray that they were charged with assaulting him with caused his death. But, it's most likely the case. He's seen on video. These two individuals are seen on video, and they're heard saying, give me the bear spray. They say it's too early, and then shortly thereafter, Sicknick and some other police officers are seen nearby, visibly trying to wash out their face. So pretty close cause and effect there, but at least they have been charged with assault.
I guess they'll say that we did that, but that doesn't kill a man. But I guess will you have to prove that the one caused the other? I mean, I'm happy to charge them with anything you can, including assaulting the police officer. But how do you prove that that's what killed him?
Yeah, you'll need expert testimony, of course. There's no question. It seems like that they are at least guilty of assault for spraying the officer. According to some literature that I read about bear spray, it's even on the label that exposure to humans can cause chest pain, cold sweat, shallow breathing, asthma sufferers may experience acute stress. So it'll be dependent on whether the prosecutors can bring forth medical evidence to support that the bear spray caused their death. But at the very least, it seems like almost a home run on the assault portion.
We called our U.S. attorney to ask him to come on and talk about where are we on the prosecution in his region of people that stormed the Capitol, and we didn't get anywhere. I'm really frustrated with the lack. Okay, we got these two guys. There were hundreds and hundreds of people there. Do you have, what is your thought about the pursuit of the people that stormed the Capitol?
Well, listen, the feds, all prosecutors, and in particular the feds, are very meticulous. They have to be, right? Because the last thing you want is to charge someone when the case is not ready and then for it to follow through. So believe it or not, I mean, these are fairly quick investigations that are being done compared to what they usually take. And that's in large part due to the incredible amount of evidence out there, right? Mostly in terms of videotape. So, you know, it's a little frustrating that you don't see more charges, but given that it's only been about 2 months, a little over 2 months, and you're already seeing two pretty strong cases, I think the pace is going a little bit quicker than the normal. Again, you have to understand that given all the investigation, all the materials, all the witnesses involved, this is a mass event. It takes time, right? It takes time to sort through all that evidence. So I think I'd be pretty pleased with these two individuals being charged.
I worry that we lose the enthusiasm or the energy, the momentum, because every day that goes on with the new administration, that stuff sort of fades into the background. Although, actually, you turn on TV, you still see that video a lot. But I don't want them to, just because time has passed, to lose their passion for these cases.
That's very true. That's a great point. And you also obviously lose people's memories.
Yeah.
But again, a couple of months in, that's very quick for this type of investigation. And believe me, you know, working with many federal prosecutors, having many on our podcast, with this kind of case, with literally an attack on democracy, they're not giving up anytime soon.
What are you thinking about the Allen versus Farrow HBO doc?
Yeah, it concluded over the weekend. I'm not quite there yet. I'm about three episodes in, but really interesting stuff. And I guess the question that's, you know, from a legal perspective, that's very interesting that we're covering today is, to what extent can Woody Allen still be prosecuted, right? I mean, it's been, you know, many years since the alleged abuse took place. I think it was in 1992 where Dylan Farrow, his adopted daughter, or Mia Farrow's daughter, alleges that he assaulted her. And the question is, can he still be prosecuted for a crime that was committed in 1992? The answer is yes. In Connecticut, where the alleged sexual assault took place, there is no statute of limitations for most sex crimes against minors. That's a good thing, right? That's where most states are headed.
Mm-hmm.
From a civil perspective, we talked earlier about civil versus criminal. So criminally, he can be still prosecuted. Civilly, if he's convicted of sexual assault, then the victim can always bring a civil suit. There's no statute of limitations there. So Woody Allen, thankfully for many who believe that he's guilty, can still be prosecuted criminally and pursued civilly. Now, whether he will be is a different story. The local prosecutor refused to bring charges back in the 90s, citing not that there wasn't enough evidence. There actually was a lot of evidence, but he said he didn't want to put Dylan Farrow, who was much younger at the time, obviously,
right,
through that trauma.
Right.
Now Dylan Farrow is much older. She has spoken for herself. She has produced testimony and tapes that really show Woody Allen in a bad light. So will there be prosecution? Possibly. Who knows? But there's still that option.
I never thought about it that way. But when you're 7 years old, how capable are you of making your case or talking about it? And what trauma do you suffer? But maybe a couple of decades later, you are able enough to now make the case. It does speak to why do people wait so long sometimes for a variety of reasons, but in this case, prosecute away.
Absolutely. And listen, Woody Allen took the offense, the offense. The name of the film is not Farrow versus Allen, as you might expect. It's Allen versus Farrow. And that's because back when this civil case was going on, it was Woody Allen who took the offensive in the custody case. Believe it or not, Woody Allen was alleging that Mia Farrow was not the proper custodian of the children. And he did that as a legal strategy. Clearly, he was a terrible parent. Even, you know, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to him, at the very least, he was having this really awkward relationship with Mia Farrow's young daughter, and he admitted to having a sexual relationship with Suni Previn. So he took the offensive and sued her, alleging that she was not a proper parent and should not have custody. He lost, and lost at the appellate court, but, that's why it's called Allen versus Farrow, not vice versa.
Really challenges us to sort of appreciate somebody for their art. Not that Woody Allen was a normal guy, but, you know, he was quirky and funny, and for a period of time, we all really liked Woody Allen. And then to discover that at the very same time, he may well have been this kind of monstrous person, it makes it hard to recollect or put in a box the man's craft. And it's kind of like what you went through with Bill Cosby, right? Here's a guy who you had to admire. You did at the time what he was doing. You were laughing. He was integrating families and television. And then at the same time, he was preying on people.
Yeah, and not too dissimilar from Roman Polanski, right? Probably the most famous case. Roman Polanski won an Oscar just a few years ago and had to accept it from a foreign country because he didn't want to face the U.S. criminal justice system. So I think you're right. I think for people who, you know, have enjoyed Woody Allen's films for years, and there's many people like that, it's very hard to reconcile that. We've seen it with Chris Brown in music, right? I mean, where do you put the crime aside from your appreciation of the art? It's a very difficult thing for most people to get their heads around.
Okay, we're out of time. But for stuff like this, Rich Lenkoff's podcast is pretty good, Legal Face-Off. He is a partner at Bryce, Downey, and Lenkoff. And you can catch the latest podcast. When does it drop, Rich?
Today, we're taping our new episode in a couple of hours, and we're covering all this, plus the rise in anti-Asian violence and the rise in fraternity hazing-related deaths. So lots of good topics today.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate your expertise.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.